Our next speaker is Paul Fromm. Paul has been out on the front lines for a long, long time. He has been exhibiting conspicuous grace under pressure. So take it away, Paul.
Well, I guess you heard that telephone ringer a few moments ago with the mariachi music. I guess I'm now finally outed. All the rumors you've heard are false. I really am an agent for Mexican intelligence. So that's that's who I am. This is kind of an interesting topic, and rather than going through my rather extensive and boring tale of woe, I'll hit a few of the highlights, but I'd like to draw a few conclusions, maybe some guidelines or some conclusions. I mean, each of our stories is different, but in some ways similar. One conclusion is, and I think we have to take this very seriously, we are up against a diabolical enemy. These are the Jacobins of the first decade of the 21st century. They mean to have our heads roll. In fact, the Jacobins at least were a little bit more classy. There'd be a formal execution. They wanted to destroy us in any way possible, and quite literally destroy. They're not interested in an argument or a debate. It's not that they think our views are misguided and they need to set us straight. We must be destroyed. This is not an intellectual debate or an argument. It is a war, and we have to be quite aware of that. We're not going to convert them, despite what a few people on our side of the fence believe. We are not going to convert these people. They must be checkmated or stopped. Well, in my own case, I lived a double life. Well, I've already admitted that. Mexican intelligence. I lived a double life for a very long time. I was a teacher by day and a hater, by night. If you want to know the sort of issues I was involved in the old days when I was relatively safe, I was very strongly anti-communist. We were involved in a whole lot of anti-communist organizations and things like that. But much more recently, for the past 20 years, my two issues are immigration and free speech. I believe there's too much immigration in it. By God, not enough free speech. After hours, when I was an English instructor, I was involved with two organizations, the Canadian Association for Free Expression and the Canada First Immigration Reform Committee. We published material. We still do. We conducted meetings across Canada. We sometimes lobbied members of Parliament and so on. And finally, through various court cases, we traced this back. So I'm not spinning conspiracy theories because I know they're not very popular here. But we know that beginning in 1991, the Canadian Jewish Congress decided that it was now time to get me. They'd gotten a more radical teacher named James Keister, who actually taught his Holocaust skepticism in the classroom. I never did. I was an English instructor. I was teaching Poe, not Steiglitz or Forresson. So they decided to get me. They approached one of my colleagues, I later found out, who was a guilt-ridden Anglo-Saxon married to a Jew. And she said, well, you're married, you teach in the same department as Mr. Fromm. We want you to be able to testify against him and give us the goods on him. Well, she said she wouldn't. She said, I don't agree with his views, but he's a good teacher. I'm not going to be part of this. But what they did do was to engineer a casual remark that I made at a public meeting into a full-scale furor. It was 1991, way, way back then, and the Toronto Mayor's Committee on Community and Race Relations was having a meeting. Now, I went down there because I was angry because that government body had tried to shut down a meeting I'd spoken at a couple of weeks before. So I thought I'd go down and there must be a public input, a moment when you can put up your hand and say your 2 cents for 30 seconds. I thought I'd wait. Well, anyway, I found out, you'd have to apply weeks in advance, so I wasn't going to get a chance. But they did have a native Indian, and he was the head of an anti-Klan organization. Not that we had the Klan much in Toronto in those days, but he was in charge of an anti-Klan organization, government-funded, of course. And so he was rambling on about all the things he wanted the committee to recommend to the government, and they wanted to recommend that the provincial government ban meetings by neo-Nazis and white supremacists and racists, ban them from renting halls, and then there's something else, and some other measure. And so I heckled. Scalp them? Well, I thought this was funny.
It was funny.
It is funny. Of course it's funny. He's an Indian, right? Yeah. Well, okay, I thought it was funny. What I was saying was, how much further would you go? Well, immediately, they were half asleep, and some old Jew finally woke up. He said scalp him! He said scalp him! So they demanded that I publicly retract my remarks. I just stood there. I'm not, retract what? So finally they called security. So a couple of these old commissionaires, or these are old army people, you know, they're 60 years old, and they're puffing and puffing. They came up and they had to expel me from the meeting. Well, okay. It was a short night. I got there about 10 to 7. I'm out by 7:25. Fine, so on my way out, the Toronto Star reporter asked me what happened. I tell him, give him my side of the story. And the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, they take a few shots of me and get home that night. And there I am on the TV. And it was kind of low-key. Free speech supporter expelled from anti-racist meeting. They had a few words from me and so on. So it sounded like a nothing story. Next morning in the Toronto Star, again, very short item. I guess it was interesting because I'd said scalp him, and even the left-leaning Star thought it was kind of funny. I thought, okay, yeah, so a little bit of publicity, life goes on. Until late that afternoon, I get called into the principal's office. The phones are ringing off the hook, and the press is in a complete dither. And the call is from the Canadian Jewish Congress, and of course the anti-Klan group headed up by the Wounded Indian and various other groups, that I must be fired. Racist teacher must be fired. So we escalate from casual remark to teacher must be fired. And we later did find out from the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress. He said, that night I was watching TV with my wife, and when we saw Paul Fromm say scalp him, I nearly spilled my milk. Now there's a real he-man snorting back his nightcap of milk. But anyway, I nearly spilled my milk, and I said to her, now we finally have him. And the next day, I'm quoting directly exactly what Bernie Farber said, the next day we got on to our friends in the media and told them exactly who Paul Fromm was. And, of course, the race was on. Well, I survived that one. The director of education, the progress is very interesting. The director of education said I was an exemplary teacher. So the initial reaction of the corporate body was to close ranks. I'm not sure they do that today. But they closed ranks. They said I was an exemplary teacher, and they had me in for a disciplinary chat, and my union sort of stood up for me. And basically they said I was not to do this again. Well, that's kind of vague. What's this? So some months went on, and I knew they were sniffing around the edges, because a year before that I'd spoken to a group called the Heritage Front on Martyrs Day rally, and they were trying to get the video of that. And the Heritage Front would not sell it. They said, we're getting orders from strange people. And so they just refused to sell them the video. But eventually, it's another long story, but they did get the video. And they went to the most right-wing paper in Toronto, the tabloid Toronto Sun, which my leftist lesbian colleagues, for the most part, said they would never read because it is a racist, sexist, homophobic paper. But when in April of 1992, I guess, they had a front page story complete with a picture of me, teacher addresses neo-Nazi rally, why all my skeptical colleagues immediately believed that I was indeed that. Now that really got the ball rolling. I'm going to skip over most of the rest of it. Again, there was a big furor. They had an inquiry about me. I was the most investigated teacher in the province of Ontario in a non-criminal matter. They appointed a lawyer. The investigation went on for 6 months. They heard from teachers. They heard from students. They heard from the general public. And the wonderful thing was virtually no student, and I've been teaching for over 23 years there, spoke against me. So that they were never able to hang anything about classroom behavior on me in that regard. So in the end, it was recommended, the recommendations were kind of legalistic and loosey-goosey and all over the place, but what the Board of Education did decide to do was to move me into adult ed. Well, that suited me fine. That was fine. And I survived for a couple more years, but I had to be very careful. I mean, much more careful than before. I would get other people to write letters to the editor that I would write. I'd write them if they'd sign them. I was careful not to conduct public meetings in the Toronto area as best as possible. Private, yes, but not public. And eventually, though, by 1997, they felt that they could actually move against me, and they did. This time they had two really incriminating things: a video of a memorial service in Urbana, Illinois. I'd gone to a memorial service for the late Reverend P. Oliver, and there were a number of people who spoke, and David Duke, Sam Dixon, a whole lot of people. So they had a video of a 20-minute talk that I'd given. Don't forget, that's 1994. We're now talking 1997. It doesn't matter, that's way in the past. So apparently that, and the fact that I had organized a free speech conference on the March break in Vancouver in March of 2006. Those were my two crimes. And it was determined that I had had to be fired because I had shown persistent contempt and disregard for multiculturalism and ethnocultural equity, which were the core values of the Board of Education. And I thought, geez, I must have missed a memo somewhere. I thought reading and writing and arithmetic and computer literacy and maybe even the ability to cooperate with others might be core values. But as I say, I must have missed a memo, because multiculturalism and ethnocultural equity would be absolutely pure cultural Marxism. They've taken the height. So anyway, I was fired. The union grieved, and we fought for years. And in the end, I lost by a 2-1 margin. So I was definitely out of that job. Some years later, they went after my teaching certificate. And again, long story, but eventually they got that too. But along the way, I had a bit of fun. I wasn't going to spend thousands of dollars for an attorney, so I decided I'd be my own. So I had a fool for an attorney, but the fool and I had some fun. And one of the things we did do, though, is to cause them a whole bunch of grief. They wanted $3 per page for a transcript. Now, the hearing was likely to last 20 days. Now, how am I going to have do a summation if I can't read the transcript? Well, I got together one of these odd guys that I know who's sort of a paralegal, and he's into a lot of this Freeman stuff and the Constitution and the Magna Carta, and we presented a motion that nearly floored them. It was two volumes of authorities. Our book of authorities was two times that thickness, a 200-page factum. And we're quoting Magna Carta, and basically he argued, listen, Magna Carta says justice shall not be sold. If Mr. Fromm cannot afford the transcript, you're selling justice. They didn't know what to make of this. Next thing we know, they cross-examined me for a bit. Next thing we know, we're told, you're getting the transcript for free. Well, that was a bit of fun, but well, you know, cost the system a bit. One of the first days of the hearing about getting ready to taking away my teaching certificate, the JDL decides to have a protest. So I'm walking into the building, and having paid $20 for my parking space, I walk into the building, and there's about a dozen of these crazy Jews with the full flag of, you know, that. You know, the triangle flag, you know, it's the flag of the bandit state. I walk through, trudge through, there are a couple of cops there, and I go into the elevator, and the next thing I know, there's mayhem all around me. Some Jew's trying to strangle me, some cops on that one, some female Jew is trying to go at the cop, some undercover female cop grabs her, so they toss these two up. That they want to give me, that they love process. So they get upstairs, and they say, well, am I all right? So what am I supposed to say? No, I'm not all right. Or I am all right. So I'm playing the victim and honor conflicts. I said, well, could I have a weak cup of tea? They decide yes. They don't know quite how to handle this. I've never had that happen before. Meanwhile, I know that one of the meanest skinheads in all of Toronto has heard about this. I phone him. He's on his way downtown because he thinks there's still going to be more of a fight, that I may have to fight my way out of the building. Anyway, they decide they're going to give me police protection. They're going to give me my own private parking space in the bowels of the building, free. So, gee, in the end, things did work out okay, and even the press publicity was okay. So, as I say, I had some fun. In the end, of course, I lost. So, conclusions. Hey, I'll talk to anybody. You know, if they press calls me, I'd be glad to talk to them. So, during all these various dramas, I would talk to the press. I'm now really more convinced of those who say, be very selective, or maybe don't talk to them at all. Now, I always have thought, even if the coverage is negative, some people will see through that. I believed that for a long time. But during the process of my being fired, I gave dozens of interviews. I only ever got 4 phone calls from people outside the movement. 2 were supportive, but nothing ever came of that. And 2 were negative. So, yeah, my phone's, my number's listed in the phone book, so, you know, anybody who wanted to ring me up and give a heavy breathing threat call, they could, but I didn't get a lot of those. But what I did notice was, if after all that publicity, some people saw through the lies, we didn't get any recruits out of it. Now, my political friends stood by me, and I had a lot of good friends, a lot of people who helped in various stages along the way. They wrote letters at crucial times, came out to meetings, and I had a lot of good friends, a lot of good support. But in terms of that publicity being a recruiting device, no, and it took me a long time to figure out what was going on. But what I believe was happening was this. People might indeed see through it. They might, even the few things that I was alleged to have said, they might say, well, I agree with him. Or a teacher should have the right to, you know, pursue, to be politically involved on his own time. But they also saw the lesson, and the lesson was, look what's happening to this guy. I don't want to get close to him. I don't want to be involved with him because the same thing might happen to me. Now, that is a lesson that, you know, I think is out there, and in terms of strategy, we just have to be aware of it. In terms of personal cost, it certainly didn't do much for my marriage. My wife at that time, we had 2 young children, I mean, my then wife. It eventually led to a parting of ways. So this sort of pressure, it costs people personally. I've got to say that when I was going through the battle, where they were asking anybody who had anything to say negative about me to come forth, the guy in Mexico is really eager for a report. In addition to some of my few ideological friends among the teaching profession, a couple of people came forward who, I don't know what your equivalent of the United Church would be, but it's maybe not quite Unitarian, but quite left-wing Christian. Well, one of these women came forth, and she said, well, she never talked politics with me much, and she probably wouldn't agree with me, but I was a good teacher and always been a good colleague. She wasn't even in my department. So, in addition to seeing the scummy aspect and the cowardly aspect of human nature, you also see the good aspect. And I have some stories, a couple of the Jewish fellow teachers, of course, any form they got, they were just only too happy to say, well, the trauma they felt, the difficulty, the fear they felt, they were scared. Well, I had a lot of fun with my massively overweight former department head at the hearings to try to strip me of my teaching certificate. She said, well, I said, well, you know, you mentioned in your written comments that I had been a member of the Klan. I said, well, how did you know that? She read it. I said, well, where did you read it? And I mean, she read it. Well, I said, was it a reputable source? I mean, obviously, you believe that. Yes. I said, well, no, you'd have seen me every day, year after year after year. Did you ever ask me about it? I mean, did I look like a Ku Klux Klansman, whatever one of those guys looks like? I mean, I still had all my teeth, and I didn't say Nigra as every second word. And, well, why would you think I was a Klansman? Did you ever ask? Well, no. Well, why not? Well, everybody said. Well, did you get a university degree? Did you ever hear anything about logic and the scientific method? You know, just because somebody's saying doesn't. It was fun. In the end, of course, the verdict was cooked and I didn't win. But it was interesting to see just how vile many of our opponents are and just how vicious. I think we have to keep coming back to the realization that it is our destruction, our elimination, that's their goal. So, in terms of handling the media, I don't have a simple advice, but I came to the conclusion over a long period of time watching my own reactions and interactions with the media and others. The most of the North American media is simply a soap opera. The news is not news, it's a soap opera. And as you know, any good soap opera has very recognizable good guys and bad guys, good girls and bad girls. And that's important. Now, when they're doing a news story, it is not to tell the news. The last thing it is about is to tell your views, or my views. It is to create, it is a soap opera. Now, who is the bad guy? Let me think. Do you think I can persuade the script writer that I'm the good guy? No, I'm the bad guy. All he needs, or she needs, really, is a few factoids or comments to hang the story on. And a colleague of mine who was murdered some years ago, he was a leader of a movement group, and he was always giving interviews to a reporter for the Toronto Sun. And the news stories were always the same. Last night, Wolfgang Droege of the neo-Nazi white supremacist Heritage Front was expelled out of yet another meeting hall. Mr. Droege, who's the leader of the neo-Nazi white supremacist Heritage Front, says, and Mr. Droege, who's a former associate of Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, it's always the same. And he would talk to this guy every day. They were like the Boobsy twins. And I said, Wolfgang, he never writes anything good about you. He said, but yes, but I get my name in the paper. I said, well, that you do. But, it's the same mantra. Yeah, I could write the story. It's just what is the fact of today? Oh, he got thrown out of the hall, or he's being investigated for something. That's the new piece of news. But as far as ever learning what he says or what he believes, you don't. It's a series of emotive adjectives and terms which signal to the audience, bad guy. Who cares what the bad guy believes? He's the bad guy. Therefore, come to the conclusion that the media should probably, especially if you're going through an incident like this, be boycotted. Probably. I mean, I'm not absolutely adamant, but in the end, if your goal is to get your point of view across, you're not going to do it. Perhaps with the exception of a small town paper or a live radio or TV, a live interview. The media, I don't think I have to convince anybody, is not on our side. For the vast majority of cases, and also their approach is soap opera, and they've already determined that we're the bad guys. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. One thing that I have thought of doing as a way of dealing with media bias is simply this: our technology today has made it possible for us to set up a camera. Filming the cameraman, filming us, right? And you can keep them honest that way. Or, if you do an interview on Skype, you can have a Skype recorder. It's a free piece of software that automatically records every Skype conversation you have. You don't even have to think about putting it on. And you can just inform the TV broadcaster, okay, I'm going to film you filming me, and if there's any monkey business, I'll make this public to the rest of the world. Or, if it's an audio interview, say, I'm recording this myself, and if there's any out-of-context quoting, I'll put the raw interview thing up on the net, and you will have egg on your face. I do think that that's now possible and is really very easy. So it is one thing that we can do to strike back at them.
Just very quickly, from my point of view, first of all, I really agree we've got with Gregory that we've got a media that we didn't have even 10 years ago, the internet, to keep them honest. We can get our own views out. But secondly, that was one of the things I found very, very odd with my colleagues. I think only two ever said, well, I've read all this stuff in the papers. What's the truth? I mean, what do you believe? We've never had a talk. I found that very odd for among people who are at least low-level intellectuals. They weren't. They're prepared to believe a paper that they disagreed with.
Well, thank you very much.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.